Alrighty. So the point of talking about the angular distribution of radiated power is like imagine you've got a quantum system. Maybe you know what nucleus or atom it is, and but its spectroscopy is maybe not that well known, or the process of excitation is not that well known. And it's going to emit radiation. How do you find out something about the state that's radiating? And one way is to, collect the radiation, some detector with some solid angle, and move that around in space. And from that, you can deduce the angular distribution of the radiated power, and that can tell you what multiple it is that's radiating, if it's one or if it's a combination of multiples. And so basically, the development here that we'll cover today is how to calculate that angular distribution of radiated power for various multiples sources of radiation. And usually, what we're talking about is going in the far zone where many, many wavelengths outside of the radiator. So, if we're looking at fields radiating outward from a localized source, which is the usual situation. Of course, there are classical reasons you would also want to know this angular distribution of radiated power. If you're designing a radio antenna or something like that, you want to know where the photons are going. So if we're looking at radiation from a localized source that's coming outward, of course, from it and propagating to larger and larger distances, we know that all the radial solutions in that we wrote last time, where we would often have a linear combination of two independent solutions when we were writing the most general form of the radial solutions, we know that all the radial solutions have to be outgoing in our spherical expansion, outgoing Hankel functions. So we can basically go straight to this and write the fields, which I'll remind you is a linear combination of electric and magnetic multiples. The general solution for these outgoing waves has to look like sum over the usual L and M. And then we have the electric multiple coefficients, which are going to govern how strong the electric multiples are, and the Hankel function, and the XLM vector spherical harmonic, which you'll remember is simply the L operator, the angular momentum operator, acting on an ordinary YLM divided by the root LL plus 1. That's what this X is, the simplest of the vector spherical harmonics. And then there is the magnetic multiple term contributes to the magnetic field with a little more complicated curl term to evaluate. Also with the X LM vector spherical harmonic. Right. And then the electric field also is governed by these set of coefficients, AE and AM, which I can write sum over L and M, I times the impedance of free space, Z naught over K, the electric multiple coefficient. The electric field from the electric multiples has that curl structure like the magnetic field due to the magnetic multiples, namely the same type of expression, curl of HL of 1 XLM of theta phi. And then the magnetic multiple contributes to the electric field with this term that is just a H times an X with a constant Z naught. So that's our starting point. We've just specialized from our most general solutions we wrote last time by only including one radial solution since we're talking about outgoing waves. And in the far zone, which is where the detection apparatus would usually be located, KR is very large. And we can use the asymptotic form of the Hankel function, spherical Hankel function, which remember goes when KR is much greater than L to minus I to the L plus 1 e to the IKR over KR. And putting that in, we have simpler expressions in this far zone, much easier to work with. H goes like e to the IKR over R times the sum over L and M minus I to the L plus 1 times the electric multiple coefficient and XLM plus the magnetic coefficient. And we can just instead of taking the curl, we can just take n hat cross XLM for this term, which is always simpler in the far zone to find the leading order terms that look like 1 over R. Right, so we're using this trick again that del goes to IK cross when you're in the far zone. And then the electric field, instead of needing to invoke all of this, we know that we have a transverse electromagnetic field propagating to large distances. And so we can simply get the electric field through the cross product of H with the propagation direction unit vector. So once you have that, we can calculate the pointing vector and get the time averaged radiated power, which I'll just write down. It's a straightforward calculation. We'll write it as dP d omega, so it's the power radiated per unit solid angle. Would be Z naught over 2K squared. The coherent sum means the sum is inside the absolute square. Coherent sum of minus I to the L plus 1. And then we have the electric multiple, and XLM cross n hat plus the magnetic multiple coefficient times XLM, all squared, absolute square. Again, this is time averaged for monochromatic radiator. One of the interesting questions is, to what extent do these different terms interfere with each other? Since it's a coherent superposition, this means, right, if I were to expand this out, I would usually do it with like dummy summation indices. I'd have a sum over L and M of this, and then it would be multiplied by its complex conjugate, and we'd have a second sum over dummy summation indices, right? And the terms where L prime M prime are different from LM are what we would call the interference terms in the expression. So, one of the things is that the different LM do interfere in general. Different multiples do interfere. However, the electric and magnetic multiples do not. And the reason for that is that, right, the L vector in the vector spherical harmonic, right, that only has unit vectors in the theta hat and phi hat direction. Right, that has partial derivatives in angles, and it has unit vectors in angles. And n hat is like r hat here, so that you're taking a cross product of two orthogonal vectors. And so their magnitudes are equal. But in particular, that also means n cross L dotted into L, which would be in those cross terms I was talking about between electric and magnetic. We know that that's zero. So electric do not interfere with magnetic multiples. So it's hard to simplify this much more without making some simplifying assumptions, which are actually realistic, like especially when you apply this to the microscopic world of a nucleus radiating or an atom or a molecule radiating. That let's suppose a single multiple is radiating. So that means a single L and M we're talking about. And one point we can see immediately is that if you have a single multiple, okay, you kill this sum over L and M here, then the angular distribution is the same for a given LM electric and a given and that same LM magnetic multiple. So like electric dipole 1, 0 radiating would have the same angular distribution of power coming out from it for that L and M if it were an electric dipole or if it were a magnetic dipole. Let's elaborate a little on that. So why is this, right? Again, it's because n dot theta hat is 0, n dot phi hat is 0, and therefore n cross xlm squared is equal to xlm squared. And so for both cases, the angular distribution of radiated power for a given LM multiple of either electric or magnetic type is Z naught over 2k squared magnitude of its coefficient for E or M squared times the absolute value of XLM squared, the dot product of it with its complex conjugate. And in the notes, I gave a more detailed expression of that, evaluating the L dot L part of that. But maybe I won't write it. It has like all these indices, L minus M, L minus M plus 1, and so on, just times ordinary spherical harmonics, which might be more convenient. I wrote at the bottom of page 100, but let's not bother writing that now. So if you're pretty sure it's a single multiple radiating, I mean, again, kind of put yourself in the mindset of the early days of nuclear physics when they knew very little about the states of nuclei. Maybe they needed to figure out what is the nature of some excited state that's produced in an experiment. This is really how it's done in those old days. That's how you find out the quantum numbers of these different nuclear energy levels. For atoms or molecules, it might also be done. So again, you can just measure this and find the multipolarity of the transition identify the L and M. But then if you want to find out whether it's electric or magnetic, you would need a polarization measurement. Right, because these terms have their electric field in different directions, depending on whether it's an electric or a magnetic multiple. And so you would need to do a polarized radiation measurement. The other quantity you're often interested in is not just the angular distribution, but you're often interested in the total radiated power. So we'd have to integrate this expression over all solid angles, integrate dp d omega. And because these obey nice orthonormality relations, we can derive the total radiated power rather easily by using these nice orthonormal vector spherical harmonics. And we use the fact that XLM or L prime M prime conjugate dotted into XLM integral d omega is a Kronecker delta. And that gives the total power radiated to be Z naught over 2k squared sum over L and M absolute AELM squared plus absolute AMLM squared, which is very nice because there's no interference whatsoever here, no coherence terms. In the total power, but there is in the angular distribution, as we saw, and in things like the polarization. So in the text, there's a table 9.1. It gives some angular distributions like a dipole radiator, electric or magnetic, sends out its power like the 1-0 multiple. Sends out power like sine squared of theta, not real directional, really going into a lot of different solid angles. Like we saw for the half wave antenna, you could get a more directional than a pure dipole emitter. If you had like a circular polarized wave, that would be more like a distribution kind of like this. And then the like the 2-0 quadrupole radiator, I think does something like that, I believe, and so on. There are different examples of that in the book. Another case, though, is where maybe you haven't prepared a specific quantum state, but you're taking something from a thermodynamic equilibrium ensemble. That's an important case, right? You make an incandescent light bulb source, or just heat up a bunch of atoms in a cell to the point where they have so much energy that excited states are populated, they're emitting radiation. So we can look at this important case of thermodynamic equilibrium. Where there's really no direction singled out. There have been collisions from all directions. All the states are populated. If you have like a p state of an atom, then basically all the m sub l 1, 0, and minus 1 would all be equally populated, and they would be all radiating incoherently. So basically, a system in thermodynamic equilibrium would usually mean that no direction in space is singled out. And as a consequence, the source radiates an incoherent sum of all the multiple components. It still might just be one multiple, like if this is an L equals one state, like that's decaying to an S state of hydrogen or some other, an alkali atom. Then for that one L value that's going to be radiating, we have to sum all the M components contributing incoherently. It's the key here. They would normally all have different phases, random phases, average out, all the coherence terms in the angular distribution. So that's pretty easy to work that out. That means the mathematical form of dp d omega for an L multiple of either the electric or magnetic type would go to z naught over 2k squared. Incoherent sum means I sum the absolute squares, xlm squared times the A of L, and I won't put an M subscript because all the ALMs for a given L are all equal if you're in thermodynamic equilibrium. Okay, but now you can work out this sum over M of XLM squared, and this is simply 2L plus 1 over pi, 4 pi, I should say, which is independent of theta and phi. And so what that means is dp d omega for a system in thermodynamic equilibrium like that is isotropic. All solid angles contribute equally. You just get spherically symmetric radiation everywhere in space. Okay. So next we're going to move into section 910 of Jackson, which is like about the last one we cover, I think. Maybe we do a little in 9. I think there's a 911 coming later. Anyway, we're nearing the end. And section 910 is talking more about kind of the scenario I've been talking about already all class, of what kinds of what happens if you really are trying to describe the full process of the generation of these radiation. What I wrote so far were always the fields outside of the system radiating, outside of the sources, outside of the region where charges and currents are oscillating. So we're still going in the following discussion, we're going to still treat monochromatic sources and fields. But now we're going to include the sources more concretely, and actually derive the equations. So how do we do that? We have to look at Maxwell's equations, which we like to do. And Maxwell's equations now, including the sources, remember everything we did up to now, we, in chapter 9, I think, well, except when we were doing the actual radiation of antennas and stuff. But at least in all the last few sections, we were always looking where outside the sources. So we're going to find there's one little trick Jackson does. We're going to look at the Maxwell equations for the electric field and for a sort of fake magnetic field, one of Jackson's tricks. This fake magnetic field is going to be defined as B over mu naught. And it's not the full magnetic field because we're going to consider systems that might have a magnetization present in the source. Right. And then, so H, the true magnetic field is not the magnetic induction over mu naught for that kind of a system. Right. Okay. So, again, M is not going to be assumed to be zero. So what are our equations? The kind of point of doing this is he's going to try to make use of the math we developed in the last section where we, if you remember, a key part of our logic was working with divergenceless fields. Okay. So B, of course, has no divergence. By setting up this H prime, we can work with H prime similar to what we were doing last lecture, starting with a divergenceless field. And remember, one could impose that boundary condition immediately by using the XLM vector spherical harmonic, because del dot any radial function times XLM is zero. So that's the point of this trick that our favorite author has introduced here. Okay, so with that, let's write Maxwell's equations in this notation. Del dot H prime now is zero, since H prime is really just B over mu naught. And so we have del dot E that's interesting. I wrote del dot E is zero, but it should be rho. Don't know what I was thinking. Yeah, that should be rho. I guess over epsilon naught. And now the curl equations, del cross E minus ik z naught h prime is zero, and del cross h prime plus ik e over z naught is equal to j plus the curl of m. And right, these are just the spatial parts of these monochromatic fields. Everything in these equations has this factor implied, this e to the minus I omega t implied. And now the idea of this derivation is to assume there are specified sources. We're going to specify them. We're not going to include any back action of radiation, then changing the source. It's the kind of standard scenario of E and M that we somehow are driving a source. It's going to radiate. And so we have sources rho of x, e to the minus I omega t. We could have a j of x, e to the minus I omega t. And let's allow for there to be a magnetization, m of x, e to the minus I omega t. We're going to include these three types of sources, but we won't include a polarization source. So So just charge is jiggling, or maybe magnets. Magnetic moments jiggling. Okay, next we have another trick from Jackson. Clever lad he was. Recall the continuity equation, right, which says for monochromatic fields, I omega rho is the divergence of the current density. And Jackson wants to be able to use divergenceless fields. That was the point of defining this H prime. And now he's going to do a similar trick. He's going to set E prime, introduce a fake electric field now, just for the mathematical derivation, which is defined to be the true electric field plus I over omega epsilon naught J. And the idea of this is that then del dot E prime will be zero. And once you're outside the source, if you calculate E prime everywhere, as we're going to do in a minute, then as soon as you're outside the source, E will equal E prime, once you're outside the current. And of course, also H prime, once you're outside the source, will go to H. Okay. But inside the source, we will have to keep track of H prime being B over mu naught, which is mu naught times H plus the magnetization density over mu naught, or just H prime is M plus H. Okay, so we're going to write now the Maxwell equations in this primed notation and show that we can basically invoke Feynman's dictum, as I like to call it. Same equations have the same solutions, and use the math we had last time to make the solutions now, even including the region inside the sources, and even in the near field, just outside of them. Be a pretty much, essentially, it's a complete solution, exact solution of this problem. Okay, so our primed equations. Now we've got del dot H prime is zero, del dot E prime is zero. We've got the curl of E prime minus IK Z naught H prime is equal to I over omega epsilon naught curl of J. And we've got the curl of H prime plus IK over Z naught E prime is equal to the curl of the magnetization. Those are the monochromatic Maxwell's equations written in this new notation. If we take the curl of these two, then we get right? We have the curl of the curl, and one of those terms had a divergence in it, which will vanish. And so that will give del squared plus k squared h prime, Goodhold, our familiar Helmholtz operator, is equal to minus curl of j plus the curl of m. And del squared plus k squared e prime is minus I z naught k, the curl of the magnetization, plus 1 over k squared curl of j. So these are inhomogeneous Helmholtz equations that we've already solved using vector spherical harmonic expansions last time. The equations in the text are 9.108, 9.109, if you want to calibrate with the text. And these are the version of the equations that are relevant when sources are present in a pretty convenient form, because they have the supplemental zero divergence conditions that we used in solving everything last time. Okay. And now I'll remind you of a point I made, I think, toward the end of last lecture. This is relating to equations 9.122 and 9.123 in the text, where we said that it's enough to know R dot E prime. If you know R dot E prime and R dot H prime, you know everything about the fields. Because these will are enough to determine the multiple expansion coefficients. And so let's see a little bit how we can make use of that. So one way to start is to consider a general vector field. I'll just call it A. I don't mean vector potential. Some general vector field. And look at del squared of R dot A. Then we can work out del squared of r dot a, which will have two pieces. There will be r dotted into del squared of a, and there will be a term twice del dot a. And so if a is divergenceless, if del dot a is zero, this del dot A is zero. Okay. And so applying it to these equations, we do have that situation. And so we can write actually the differential equations directly using this trick for these quantities, because once you know these quantities, you know the entire fields. You just have to know the dot product, right, of R onto those fields, which is these are scalar functions now, much more convenient to work with, and solve for these scalar functions, and we'll have everything we need. So that's the logic of the following development. Is that okay? Are you happy? Another point that's useful is that R dotted into the curl of A can also be written as R crossed into the gradient operator dotted into A, right? Interchange the dot cross like we can always do. And now we see sitting here something that looks like the momentum operator in quantum mechanics. And so this, in fact, is something like the angular momentum operator. That's also IL dot A. Okay, so with those tricks, we have equations like this. Del squared plus k squared, now acting on this scalar function, r dot h prime, is minus il dotted into j plus the curl of m. And similarly, del squared plus k squared r dot e prime is z naught kl dotted into m plus 1 over k squared curl of j. So let's solve one of these, or both of them. Why not? If we have no boundaries in space, we can solve these scalar equations using the ordinary scalar Helmholtz-Green's function. Right? So, with no further ado, the solution will be I over 4 pi. I'm just writing the waves generated by these sources now. As we know, this could in principle have another solution, arbitrary solution of the homogeneous problem present, but I won't write that one. That would be coming from the other radio stations that happen to be sending out waves at that exact frequency omega over 4 pi. So we'll have the Green's function integrated over the inhomogeneity, actually the negative of the inhomogeneity, I think. No. Yeah, I think the negative. If in doubt, you have to go back to the way the delta function, right-hand side, was written in the Green's function to remember the sign, which I'm too lazy to do right now. So I'll assume I got the sign right in my notes. Del prime cross m of x prime d cubed x prime. as they say, the problem has been reduced to quadrature. And the electric field dotted into R, the kind of modified electric field dotted into R, fake electric field, we'll have a solution minus Z naught K over 4 pi, integral of our Green's function, times its inhomogeneity, which is L prime, dotted into the magnetization now, M of x prime plus 1 over k squared, primed curl of j of x prime, d cubed x prime. Well, we're trying to do all this in spherical coordinates with spherical expansions. So let me remind you of this lovely equation. The spherical expansion of the Green's function Helmholtz equation. Which we all know and love. This will equal, if I set R greater to be R lesser to be R prime, because we're now looking at the Green's function outside, at observation points outside of the source, then this will equal IK sum over L and M, Hankel function, times a YLM of theta phi. These are the observation coordinates, unprimed. And then we have the primed coordinates, JL of KR prime, the regular spherical Bessel function, and the conjugate of YLM of theta prime phi prime. For the source coordinates, you're going to integrate over. And then the equations we wrote last time, after you've done these these integrals, you've got these functions, scalar functions. Then the equations I wrote last time tell you all the multiple expansion coefficients, namely for the magnetic multiples, they will be given by this, k over root LL plus 1, integral of an ordinary spherical harmonic, conjugated times R dot H prime d omega over HL of 1 of KR. And the electric multiple similar. K, except there's an extra Z naught factor, root LL plus 1, integral YLM star over R dot E over all solid angles. You can pick basically any R and then divide that. That has to be proportional, if you remember, to an HL of 1. So then you can just divide that by HL1 of KR. And now you have the multiples, and those give you every field. Including the full vector nature. There are some further simplifications in the notes. I just don't think you're going to really love it if I write those equations, though. So maybe I won't. Some couple of further simplifications, but they're in the notes. If you ever need to do this, you would consult these, but you're not going to get it from what you jot down, what I write on the board. So let's, instead of doing that, let's skip ahead to section 9.11. This math is how you can solve with this Jackson trick of defining the primed fields. You can use this to calculate the radiation from monochromatic sources quite generally. Like a lot of physics, comes down to doing integrals. So, section 9.11. We're going to now kind of dive a little bit into the quantum world and use these ideas. So this is about multiple radiation in atoms and nuclei. Guess we could toss molecules in there if we wanted, but let's keep it simple. So what we can do using everything we've learned about how sources radiate, we can apply that to radiating atoms or excited states of nuclei. And what we can do is we'll actually learn something about the lifetimes of atomic, excited atomic or nuclear states. And course, we've been doing classical E&M so far. So to extend this, where we know what actually happened was a photon was emitted, we have to bring in the idea of photons to some degree. So we'll basically be making a semi-classical approximation here. Add that on top of all this classical physics. So one way to view this is that we could estimate the lifetime of an atom or nucleus that's radiating out its energy into the wild blue yonder. It's going to have a lifetime, any state, right? It's got some amount of energy, it's been excited, that energy is going to come out. And if the radiating system is radiating with some power P, total power P, then the power, the energy per unit time, times that lifetime, we expect to correlate with the energy radiated. In the event. And usually we define gamma, the rate of radiating photons, is 1 over tau, right? Which is like one would often calculate this in the Fermi Golden Rule. What is it? This is the transition probability per unit time, per second. This gamma, which is the inverse of the lifetime. And so basically, gamma we could also write as the total power energy per second radiated divided by the energy, which is going to be the energy of the photon if this is a one single photon radiation step. Whether it's electric dipole or magnetic dipole or electric quadrupole photon, these are normally going to be emitted as a single photon. Only if you have a forbidden transition like 2s of hydrogen to 1s, this is forbidden because J equals 0 to 0 is forbidden by the Wigner-Eckardt theorem. This has to proceed with two photons. So I'm not considering that scenario now, but just single photon emissions. So you might think, well, all this classical stuff shouldn't apply because now you're in the quantum world, but actually all these formulas do still work. So let's combine some of the equations in the text, namely 9.155 and 9.169 to 9.172, if you want to check my algebra, which says that for an electric multipole radiating, this gamma E for a given single single wave multiple, its rate of emission probability per second of emitting a photon is omega z naught k to the 2L over 2 h-bar 2L plus 1 double factorial squared L plus 1 over L, and then we have QLM plus QLM prime squared. One reason I'm writing these formulas is it's going to lead us to make some order of magnitude estimates for how strong is the quadrupole radiation versus the dipole radiation, things like that. That's kind of the point of this discussion. The same expression holds for the magnetic multiple rate, decay rate. Just change this QLM, the electric multiple moments, change those to magnetic multiple moments divided by the speed of light. So let's use this to make some order of magnitude estimates. So like the electric multiples, order of magnitude, QLM, remember, was the integral of the charge per unit volume rho times R to the L times the YLM integrated over the size of the charge distribution. And what is the order of magnitude of this? I claim it is the charge on the fundamental charge. It's that order of magnitude times the size to the lth power. Pick a radius comparable to the size of the blob radiating, the nucleus or atom. A measure of the system size. QLM prime was defined as minus IK over L plus 1 times speed of light, integral of R to the L, YLM conjugate, divergence of R cross M, d cubed x. So if we assume that the particles radiating have mass M, in the case of an atom, this would normally be the electron mass. For a nucleus, it would probably be the nucleon mass. Then the magnetic moments, their order of magnitude, or of order EH bar over M. So the magnetization density is of order EH bar over the mass times the volume, which will be of order R cubed. Okay. So the QLM prime, its order of magnitude is of the order of H bar omega over MC squared E times R to the L. So what does that mean? Whether we're talking about atoms or nuclei, the energies of typical photons, right, it might be of the order of EV for atoms, might be of order MeV or KeV to MeV for nuclei. H bar omega for typical radiative transitions that are important is going to be much smaller than MC squared. And so for both atoms and nuclei, the QLM, the unprimed terms, are going to be much larger than the primed electric multiple terms for both atoms and nuclei. I need more chalk. Did more writing today than usual, even though I skipped some. And we can do the similar orders of magnitude estimate for the magnetic multiples. Did I write those? Let me just give the similar estimate. The order of magnitude of these includes the 1 over C that was in that formula I wrote. MLM plus MLM prime I guess I haven't squared it. It's of the order of EH bar over MC R to the L minus 1. So we can compare the rate of radiation for electric versus magnetic, or actually the other order, gamma, for a single multiple LM magnetic divided by gamma for that same LM electric. The order of magnitude is E H bar over MC R to the L minus 1 squared over E squared R to the 2L. Okay, and so we can simplify that. The R to the 2Ls cancel, and this ratio is H bar squared over M squared C squared and 1 over R squared. Okay. So let's apply this to an atomic electron radiating. And actually, radiative transitions in atoms are of kind of two qualitatively different types, depending on whether they're the valence or the deep inner shell electrons doing the radiating, as you might expect. You know X-rays. Thought so. So for atomic electron in some particular shell, thinking within the independent electron approximation, or Hartree-Fock, if you like, which is a pretty good qualitative picture, at least for most atoms, it will seize sort of an effective charge Z effective, and the radius of that shell would be of the order of the Bohr radius over Z effective. And of course, Z effective would be around 1 for a valence electron. It's moving outside the closed shell core, like for an alkali atom, but it would be about the nuclear charge for deep inner shell transition, like you make a vacancy in the 2p shell of uranium. That's going to radiate down, or if I have, maybe it's more of I have a vacancy in the 1s shell that the 2p electron can radiate down into. And this is the valence case, it would be 1. So for that, the ratio of these multiples, magnetic over electric, would be of order Z effective over 137 squared. If we do this in atomic units, because when atomic unit C is approximately 137 atomic units of velocity. And so for valence shell, the electric will dominate. Very strongly over magnetic. But for deep inner shell, they can be comparable. Because Z effective, like uranium, that's going to be, close to 90. Moreover, the lower L or I'm out of time. I just have one more comment. Maybe I'll make it next time, but just a few comments next time before we dive into scattering and diffraction, which is really cool. We will learn why the sky is blue. Okay, let's stop there.